And the Oscar for Best Picture goes to One Battle After Another, whose cinematographer is from small town Wisconsin.
Hey, Scott, if you're from Hollywood, all of Wisconsin is small town.
Michael Ballman grew up in Brandon, Wisconsin, about 60 miles northeast of Madison in Fond du Lac County.
Hey, isn't that where you're from?
Phil, lots of amazing people are from Brandon, population 872 when Mike and I were growing up there. We were buddies, went to school together, and played in bands through college. I remember bragging to my kids when they were little that I knew a guy who helped make Stuart Little and then Hunger Games.
Mike was a gaffer and lighting technician back then. Now he's in charge of the cameras, working with three-time Oscar-winning filmmaker Paul Thomas Anderson and big-name stars such as Leonardo DiCaprio, Sean Penn, and Teyana Taylor.
We're going to talk with Mike today about his path from rural Wisconsin to Hollywood and some of the politics surrounding the latest movie he was a big part of. On today's Center Stage with Milford and Hands, the Wisconsin State Journal's political podcast from the sensible center of Wisconsin politics, I'm Scott Milford. I'm the opinion editor at the State Journal.
And I'm Phil Hands. I'm the editorial cartoonist at the Wisconsin State Journal.
And we are two-fifths of the Wisconsin State Journal editorial board.
The more cinematic two-fifths.
Michael Ballman, welcome to Center Stage with Milford and Hands. Congratulations, my friend. How exactly did a guy from Brandon, Wisconsin, about an hour north of Madison, get on the stage at the end of the Oscars this year as part of the team that won Best Picture for One Battle After Another? How'd you pull that off, my friend?
Oh, it's been a journey, you know. I think, I like you said, grew up in Brandon and, product of Wisconsin state school system and higher education system, because I went to University of Wisconsin Oshkosh. Yeah. And then ended up moving out to LA and got into American Film Institute. And then just came out of that and just started working in the industry. And eventually, about 15 years ago, I started working with Paul Thomas Anderson on his first movie called the first movie I did with him was called The Master. And I was worked a lot as a gaffer, which is the head of the lighting department. You kind of worked very closely with the cinematographer and all that. And so over the years, Paul and I have done a lot of stuff together. And then, One Battle was our fifth movie together. And then, we made that about, we did that movie in 2024 and it just really caught wind at the right time. And, with the great, not just the quality of the film, but just the timeliness of it and everything. And then we ended up, just off to the races. And next thing I know, I'm standing on the stage and I'm like, wow, this is an odd space to be in.
You're by DiCaprio, you're by Del Toro standing there on stage. You also were nominated for Best Cinematographer. Yeah. And you did win the British Best Cinematographer Award. How has that changed your life?
I haven't been working as a cinematographer that long. It's only been like maybe 5 years. And most of my career was just, I was still working in lighting and, working as a gaffer, which is great. Cause you get to see so many different styles of how cinematographers work. And, since all this stuff, especially on One Battle has happened, it's been a lot, just meeting a lot of new people and a lot of new opportunities. And it's really stuff that I don't think would have, it probably would have not happened had not been for for that film, so it's been quite something, you meet some really interesting people.
Can you back up a little bit, Mike? Because I don't know the industry as probably as well as a lot of people, but what's the difference between like a director and a cinematographer? Like who's, so you're, sure. Are you just kind of executing the vision of of the director in these cases, or how much creativity do you have when you're setting up shots and such like that?
I mean, you know, every relationship is different. And so, like, you know, the director, you know, obviously they're basically the vision for the film. And, but, you know, different directors have different skill sets and strengths and weaknesses, like everybody does. And so, you know, for example, like, you know, with Paul, he's really, you know, he's a very, you know, he writes his own material a lot. And he had won best adapted screenplay for the film. You know, and so he comes at it with a, you know, this particular film was different in making it than some of the other films had done. But for my role with him is, you know, you're collaborating. He has a really strong sense of lenses and framing and things like that. So he brings a lot of that to the party. And, you know, you kind of, so that's his communication style. It's like, oh, hey, I'd like to be here and we can see this and, you know, explaining in that manner. Whereas you work with other directors who maybe are more skilled working with actors, and they're more about the performance. And so they don't really, where do you think we should put the camera? Or should we do this? And so you just kind of have, as a cinematographer, you just kind of have to adapt your role to however you get the ball down the field, you know, if I'm going to use a sports analogy. And because at the end of the day, you know, making movies is something that is, you know, you have a certain amount of work every day that you have to achieve. And it's your job as a cinematographer to make sure you're achieving the director's vision, making sure that we're making the day, so to speak, you know, that we're getting everything that we're supposed to do. And you know, and then still providing whatever support you need to, you know, do. Sometimes you've had times the directors are like, you know, like there's, you know, like all of us, everybody has ups and downs in the job. And it's just where you're providing that kind of support.
Can you just walk me through one scene I thought was really compelling, which was at the very end, that car chase where it feels like you're on a roller coaster the whole time? How does that come together?
To go granular, I mean, basically it was at the, so that location, like in the script, it was that there was always going to be like some sort of a car chase, but it wasn't really certain on how, what the approach would be like. And so, our location manager was looking for, had found another location, which in the movie, he had found the location where the bounty hunter drops Willa, who's Chase Infinity, off, and, you know, to basically drops her off, and there's the dude who's got all the red hair, and you know, he drops her off in this area called Camp 1776. And so when he found that location, which is on the border with Arizona by the Colorado River, he's driving and he sees this road. And he's like, wow, this road is crazy. And he was like, you know, it's very hilly and all this. And he's like, wow, this is really unique. So he let Florencia Martin, the production designer, he told her about it. And the two of them looked at it together. And then they were like, hey, let's bring the core team out just to look and see if this might be a location. And so we went, it's about 4 hours outside of LA. And it's this two-lane highway that's on the lower part of California, but it's very heavily trafficked with trucks and stuff, because there's really, it's a way that people, you know, bring stuff into Arizona. And so we're out there, we're running around and, you know, driving, and we're in a minivan, and Mike, the location manager, is in his truck, and, you know, we're just, you know, with the iPhone, you just start looking at stuff, seeing, oh, wow, it goes up and down. Okay, that's wild. Okay, cool. And then, you know, you just look at lens positions and where you can put cameras on the side of the road and things like that. And, but then when we actually were shooting it, which was a few months later, we were only allowed to lock the road up, for 20 minutes at a time, I think it was. Huh. And so then they give you like a 4 mile stretch, 3 mile stretch that they would lock up. So it's, you know, the state police and all that, and hold traffic. And then we could shoot for 15, 20 minutes. And then we'd have to pull over to the side, and then they would release all the traffic. And then it would take about 30 minutes for them to release traffic, get everything through. Then they'd lock it up again. And so that's how you have to kind of plan your day of, like, you have these things. So then in that 20 minutes, you better get as much stuff as you can. And so, you know, we had these, there's a company that they're called, there's a guy named Alan Padelford, who's like a legend in the business as far as his driving skills. And so he has a company called Padelford Camera Cars. And they build like these Porsche Cayennes and Mercedes that have cranes and arms on them so they can get the, you can move the camera around as you're driving. And so we had this thing and we got the camera down. You know, you could get, these are the guys you call when you want to get the camera 4 inches off the ground and go 100 miles an hour. Because they're all like precision drivers and they do all this stuff and they do tons of stunt work. And so then they would just, so we'd have one camera point in front with a car, you know, and one camera pointed, mounted to the rear of the other car and looking backwards. So you could run those both at the same time. And then about a mile down the road, there was another car, you know, doing stuff too. So you could get three, basically three things at once in that 20-minute stretch. And then every day we'd look at the, footage. Because we're looking on these little monitors that are like, you know, this big, like, you know, the size of a phone. And it's really hard to judge everything when you're seeing it in that. So then with Paul, we always project, you know, the footage from, project what's called dailies, which is the footage from that you've shot. And so then when you're looking at it, you're able to see like, okay, yeah, this is good. Let's do more of this. Let's do less of this. And then Andy Jurgensen, who's the editor, was always with us. And he's cutting things away and putting, you know, he's cutting together things and figuring it out. So that's kind of how it all, that's the rough version of how it's done. But there's, it was not nearly that fluid. I mean, you know,
how
stuff
long
to break
did it take, Mike?
That was like, I think it was like 6 days of that, five to six days.
And it's about a minute and a half of footage in the film?
Yeah. And when you, and it's interesting when you look at the film and if you watch that with, I think so much of the film, that sequence that you're speaking of really works is because the, you turn this, you know, the score is amazing. Johnny Greenwood's score is like so interesting with the drums and all that. So if you turn the sound down and you watch the sequence, it has a very different effect. And, you know, and also the sound design, because like each car has its own individual motor sound. And so they recorded every car and then, you know, so that when you, it's just another way, it's the level of sound design and score and that, it just strengthens the image. It's tremendous. It's really wild.
The cars are so far apart, but you've built so much tension with what a car chase could be without it being, you know, right next to each other and super fast. And just, it was really artistically interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mike, I appreciated the Wisconsin scene in the movie, which is where the two characters are in the car drinking beer and DiCaprio takes a swig right as he goes by the cops. I thought, oh, there's some Wisconsin.
Oh, yeah. That's for certain.
Referencing.
Yeah. Totally. Yeah. That's pretty funny, that whole beer thing. And like, you know, Sensei's always got his beers.
Was he always drinking Modelo or what? Did it used to be Bud Light before the Bud Light got canceled? Was it always going to be Modelo beer?
I don't even know if there was really beers in the script, if I remember correctly. I think that was just something that, like, one of the things that's different about this movie usually, with Paul is usually he, when he writes something, you would hear very closely to what the script is or the concepts and all that kind of stuff. But this movie, he was really about, like, creating environments that there could be a lot of improv. And, you know, when you're working with, like, that caliber of actor, like Leo and Benicio and Sean and all those guys, it's like they're bringing a lot to the party. And I think the Modelo thing was something that Benicio, I'm sure I know him and Paul probably talked about it, but it wasn't written down like that, you know? So yeah, it's funny how it's like turned into a thing now, like the two small beers and all that, which is, you know, that was just like a total improv moment, you know?
Just a total Wisconsin line, a few small beers.
So you and I grew up in Brandon, a couple blocks apart, Paled around. And I remember you having the high score at the arcade in Brandon. I remember some D&D. Of course, you and I played in bands for years together. Even when you went to UW Oshkosh and you got your radio, TV, film major, even then I sort of remember you being a DJ, not doing movies. So I guess I'm wondering, when did this switch flip? And or was it always there and I just didn't see it? When did you just become enmeshed in movies?
I mean, I think when I was at Oshkosh, I was really like, I didn't know what the hell I wanted to do, you know, like many folks. I remember you were down in Madison and I think I was just, you know, I'd started in the radio TV film department, it was just, it didn't have the elegance of like, okay, this is our film division and this is our television division. It was kind of all mushed into one thing. And so you just, we were bumping into everything. And because of that, I remember just the, seeing these film cameras, which were old news cameras, because the news used to be shot on 16 millimeter film back in the day. And before there was videotape. And so they had this camera called a CP16, which is this, the thing is built like a tank, but it's a news camera from like the 60s and 70s. And so they had that, and they had some of these little French cameras called Beaulieus. And we had some Bolexes and things like that. And I was just like, what is all this stuff? And I mean, and back then it was like, you know, you really had to be committed to it, because you had to go buy the film. So you had to have the money for that, and you had to shoot it. And then you had to get it developed, which was involved sending it to Chicago. And so it was really like, it was a process. And then just to try and get it so you could actually use it. So it was like, it was not an easy pursuit back then. And so, you know, but I just started messing around with these things, and I was like, wow, this is kind of interesting. And then, you know, you know how it is, like everything, you find groups of friends who have similar interests. And then this guy, Reuben Whitmore, who was one of my classmates, and he and I just started geeking out about this stuff. And we ended up doing there's some contest to do a public service announcement. And so we pulled together like $500 and did this PSA and entered it into this contest, and it won first prize. And it was supposed to be like, not something about drinking, like, don't, you know. And so we did this whole thing about in a classroom where kids are talking about how, like, hey, what do your parents do? And like, my dad's a firefighter and my mom's a teacher and my da da da. And the one kid's like, what's your parent do? And my dad drinks. And, you know, we had like crazy, you know, crazy home life stuff happening. And so we had put this thing together and submitted it. And then it won. And the next thing I know, I get this call from my friend. He's like, I just saw that PSA in front of the Cubs game. And I was like, what? And yeah. And then based off of that, I was like, well, and then I applied for AFI and Columbia College in Chicago, and, you know, and off to the races.
How does the whole Wisconsin thing play out there? Because you're this guy coming from what I assume a lot of people think is kind of
the sticks.
Hick state. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Oh yeah. No, definitely. I mean, it's definitely like, you know, look, what's interesting is that, like, obviously Wisconsin is much more predominant than it was back in the 90s, as far as like what you just said, like people are like, dude, because when I went to AFI, I mean, you're talking people from all over the world. So there's folks from all over Europe and just incredible people, incredibly gifted, all this stuff. And I'm like, what am I doing here? This is insane. You know, just moving to LA is insane. But then like all that is even crazier. And I think it was just like, you know, I just kept my head down. And people are like, you're from where? Where is that? And I said, I tell people it's north of Chicago. And that was kind of like most people knew where Chicago was, you know, which is good. So,
did you get some Midwest cred for honesty or hardiness or anything like that? Or or no real,
I don't think there was too much of that. I think it was more just like, you know, look, you're here now. But then what's funny now is like, obviously in the past 10 years, the role that the state has played, like,
politically,
elections politically. And so then it's like, even Paul is like, not your, you know, he's always like, your people, look what your people are doing to this kind of fun country of ours, you know? And I think that a lot of that was our over the years, our back and forth dialogue would always be about politics. Cause I'm, you know, I'll send him stuff or he'll text me something or whatever. And it's like, I think that also, especially in the last few years when he was writing One Battle, it was kind of seeped into the thought process of that film.
How much of that, this is a political podcast, so let's get into politics here for a minute. Yeah. How much of this movie was intended to reference what was going on with ICE, or was it more just kind of a coincidence that Minneapolis happens and your movie's happening and I'm putting it together?
I mean, like, we shot this thing from January to July of 2024. So this is before Trump got reelected.
Biden's president at the time. This is before Biden even before he even drops out of the race, right? This is
Yes. I remember we were in El Paso shooting when that first debate happened between Biden and Trump. And it was like, that's when, you know, like the five alarm fire debate happened.
You're like, shit, this movie's going to actually become reality.
Well, and I was talking, when we were making it and we got into, like when you saw, like, what, I mean, you know, obviously ICE at the time was nothing like what it is now.
Yeah. Or,
and so, but I just remember saying to Paul, I said, if Trump gets elected, this movie's going to be a documentary. And, you know, and, but even, I just think, like, what, like, as over the top as the performances were, and like, oh, this is crazy. How crazy is this? Well, let's make it even crazier. It wasn't crazy enough. And it's like, it's almost like, dude, there, you know, and so that was like, there's times that there's been, you know, especially in our meme culture and like, you know, like going, who's the guy, Greg Bovino, when he got axed, and I was getting tons of memes from people that were showing that last scene in One Battle when Sean Penn finally gets into the Christmas Adventurers Club and they execute him, you know, they gas him, and everybody's like, oh, here's Greg Bovino going into his new
spoiler
office, you know. Yeah, exactly.
Well, he's just a dead ringer for him,
even at that same Nazi haircut. I mean,
Bovino and Lockjaw, it was like, so that wasn't actually planned. That was just kind of,
nobody knew who Bovino, when we were making it, nobody knew who Bovino was. I mean, the only people that we talked about that, I, you know, like we talked about, like, I mean, like, I remember when I first heard of, I had heard of, you know, like Stephen Miller a while back. And even when he was still kicking around in Trump won, and he gave some speech, and I remember sending it to Paul, and he was like, who is this dude? This is, I don't know, whatever, 2019, 2018, you know? 2017.
The head of the Christmas Adventurers Club.
Yeah, exactly. And it was just like, he is a person with does a lot of research. So like, you go to his house and there'd be books on like Supreme Court, and there'd be books on like, you know, he had a copy of Hate Monger, which is the book about Stephen Miller, and just like trying to, you know, he does a lot of research and he just kind of shaped this stuff and so the whole thing is.
Well, and as much as it was a send up to some degree of that right wing militarism in our cities, at the same time, there were plenty of jabs at the radicals too.
Completely. Completely. And I think go ahead.
I love the guy on the phone who, like, you know, was talking about microaggressions being made against him and how he didn't feel safe in the moment talking with Leonardo DiCaprio's character. And then it turns out to be some old guy, which was hilarious. I mean, yeah, it was such a great send up of the modern left.
I think that's the thing, is just like, you know, at the end of the day, it's the, and again, and obviously it's, you know, if you read any Thomas Pynchon, he's just all about like, characters in all of his films are just like so over the top. I mean, his new book, Shadow Ticket, is about a Wisconsin cheese heiress, you know, and a submarine that appears in Lake Michigan in the 30s and 40s. And it's like, it's just like, what? And so he already, just in the source material, you have the luxury of like bending things in ways that are just completely off the chain. And, you know, to what you said, it's just like, it's just, the movie is, I think it skewers both equally, because it just causes people to think, you know, like the black, you know, the French 75, which is obviously heavily influenced by the Weathermen. And there's a podcast called Mother Country Radicals, which was done. It was a podcast that the son of Bernadine Doran did. And it's really fascinating. And that was just kind of like, these are the things that were just kind of like, you know, how this movement that's trying to, you know, change the world or whatever, just splinters and things go sideways, and, you know, just the complexity of humans like getting in the mix and all this.
With the timing of it around ICE and Minneapolis in particular, it seems to me that there was an impact, and it probably wasn't intended, but I think in the public psyche, so many people came out to see this movie. And I would think one lasting impact would be, as much as you do point out some of the strengths and weaknesses of all the characters, I think the main impact on society this year may have been to turn the public to some degree against ICE more than they even were. I mean, I think there was an impact there.
Yeah, I mean, you know, look, I think it's just with everything that's been going on, especially in the last few months. And it's really, it's just wild because, like, when we shot, like, the riot scene and all that, that was in, I don't know, that was early summer, not even, maybe it was late spring of 24, you know, like all the stuff in the streets in El Paso, which we shot in El Paso, where they're, you know, the cars on fire and blowing up and all this kind of stuff. And that was all like, you know, this, there wasn't even like ICE in its current form. Like, you know, it was still just like a rather benign thing. And, you know, I mean, then when we shot that, it's interesting because the beginning of the movie, we shot at the end of the film. So the beginning where Perfidio Beverly Hills is scouting out the camp that they're going to bust out all the folks that have been incarcerated. Like, we shot that at the end, and we had originally shot that sequence at a different location, and then locations somehow was able, they were like, Paul was like, look, this isn't, we got to figure out another approach to this. And locations was because of the, we had done so much work at the border, like when Perfidia Beverly Hills crosses into Mexico, like 20 minutes into the film, you know, so Mike Glazier, the location manager, had a decent relationship with Border Patrol, and they let us set up this camp, Flo designed this camp that was like on a road that is literally right next to the border. And we would be shooting and you would see people who would cross through, and they would just walk right through the set. And you see every now, we had to keep a lane open because every now and then ICE would come down, but it wasn't like military. It was like some dude in a pickup truck. And it was like, and it was just like, you know, we're down at the border fence, like down there, like lighting it and all that business. And it was just like, it was just such a different energy than, you know, like the, it was, this is like the benign state rather than the military ICE state. I mean, it wasn't benign back then, but it was like not anything near like what it is now. And so, yeah.
New York Times did a podcast about ICE and how it's changed. And like, you know, for ICE, for its entire history, has been sort of a very deliberate investigative body that's gone after targeted people. And it's a very new thing that they're sort of in force on the streets doing kind of mass roundups. It's not really what their skill set was before the Trump administration.
Yeah. No, I mean, and that was, so that's the fact that like what you're saying, Scott, is just like how it, there wasn't like an intention of like, okay, let's, you know, this is going to happen. I mean, there was just no idea that it would go what it was. I think it was just like this kind of like pinch-y, hey, let's really push the limit of like how ridiculous we can make this. And then, you know, just with the way the administration is and everything, the fact that it like overlapped in that fashion is like completely nuts.
Because sadly, the movie doesn't seem very ridiculous at all. I mean, it's a slight caricature of maybe some of the ICE agents in particular, but like the Bovino character feels like a dead ringer. Doesn't feel like a caricature at all. And the left is maybe slightly caricatured, but there, you know, there's some pretty radical militant people out there nowadays. So,
what
started off as, I guess, something that was supposed to be absurd feels sadly, you know, realistic.
Yeah. No, and I mean, and there's definitely a lot of references that, like, I remember when that scene where Sean goes and meets the Christmas Adventurers, when Lockjaw meets the Christmas Adventurers for the first time, and he gets into the elevator and he licks the comb and he's doing his hair. And that was so straight gross. Off of that, but that was straight. I mean, I remember Sean, he had that clip from Paul Wolfowitz, because that was Paul Wolfowitz did that before an interview. And I think there was some footage of it in some movie or something. And maybe it might have been, I can't remember what it was, but he had a clip of it. And he was shot. Okay, so he does it. He did his hair this way. He licks this first. And he was like basically mimicking exactly what that action was. So it's, it's crazy, you know.
I just loved that scene where with Sean Penn in the elevator, how they're there at the day of the guy's daughter's wedding. You know, it's sort of like you have to soften these monsters by making them, you know, parents, just like in The Godfather, right?
Well, yeah, and it's like Tony Goldwyn, who's like, you know, that's, you know, just looks great and is, you know, and it's just like this. Oh yeah, so do you consider, you know, have you ever, you know, when he's asking him all those questions, have you done anything against this, this, you know, this fine nation? Or he doesn't say that, but it's a version of that, you know. And he's like, you know, have you ever been in an interracial relationship? And then the other guy, who's one of the lead writers, used to be one of the lead writers for SNL, and he's hilarious, Sandy, the guy, and he was, you know, just with his like, no more lunatics, you know. We are your ideals and ours are the same. No more white. What is it? No more punk trash haters and lunatics. No more lunatics.
Yeah, I mean, it was an action film and it was had a lot of political vibe to it, but at the same time, it was a comedy to some degree too.
Oh yeah.
Do you
No,
think?
definitely. Oh yeah, totally. I mean, look, that's why it won the Golden Globe for best comedy. And in the times when it can be classified as either, if it's not like the Academy only has one classification for best picture, but like some of these other awards have a classification for drama and a classification for comedy, and it would always fall in the comedy category. So yeah, I think people really look at it as a there's a huge comedic element to it. And but at the same time, what's interesting is how it kind of bookends with the like the whole parent and, you know, being a parent and you know, trying to understand your path as a parent and supporting your kid and all this kind of stuff. And you know
While
how
firing a semi-automatic weapon.
yes, exactly.
So I actually found the Sean Penn character Lockjaw to, I mean, I could tell how that would be funny if we hadn't just had Greg Bovino on the scene for the last 5 months, basically. And so seeing that as sort of a caricature of that, even though I know that you'd made the movie before that, it felt like it took a little bit of the humor off because it felt so real.
Phil, I won't name names, but so did some of the characters on the left. Living here in Madison, anyway, there's a
Oh
real
yeah.
familiarity there, too.
The thing about like Lockjaw, which is so, I mean, this is like, it's just Sean Penn kicking ass because he's just such a talented actor. And the fact that he has this character that he's created who looks like this militant hard ass who's gonna, you know, like you said, like the Bovino type, but he secretly has this self-loathing for himself because he, as much as he wants to strive to be a Christmas adventurer, he can never achieve it because he just connects with black women, and that was his downfall ultimately. And you know, because they wouldn't accept him as, you know, in that role.
As pure.
Yeah.
I liked he looked like he literally looked like he was walking around with a stick up his butt the entire movie. I mean,
Yep.
like that's
Yeah.
just a great portrayal, you know.
Yeah. No.
We
Yeah. He just did it all. The physical, all the stuff with his mouth. Like, you know, he's always like, you know, you know, and then wearing that prosthetic at the end and all that stuff. You know, that was, yeah.
Mike, Phil and I interview lots of politicians, governors and senators, and occasionally maybe a presidential candidate, though not Trump. We've never had
Yeah.
the honor.
Yeah.
But after a while, you realize they're all pretty much ordinary people, and they
Yeah.
just are good talkers, maybe, but and debaters. But talk about a bit about just being around so many famous people all the time. What's that
I
like,
mean,
or do you not think about it anymore?
I think it's like when you're making a movie. And especially this film, for example, because we were so in the, I mean, we shot for almost 100 days, and it was in a lot of different locations. This is, you know, sometimes on a movie you'll just go to this, you'll go to the studio every day and you'll sit in the, you know, and the actors have their trailers, and the interactions are very different. But on this particular film, we everybody was in the, you know, Paul, you know, we're shooting in practical locations. It was hot. It was just uncomfortable situations all the time. Paul was really adamant that we had a very small crew, keep it as small as possible. And you know, like normally Leo has, and a lot of these folks have like a big trailer where they stay and they have their team, they have their own hair and makeup people and all this kind of stuff. And he didn't want any of that because he wanted as minimal amount of people as possible. And all the cast was on board with it. And so I'd see like Sean, he would have his Rivian and he would just park it behind the truck, and you'd see him asleep in there with his feet on the dash. and his assistant next to him, like typing emails or something. And then he would just hang, and then it'd be like, you know, and it was just a very normal situation of like, you know, just you're right there with him all the time. And I think when you're making a film, everybody's working towards the same goal. And especially this one, because it was just, you know, a lot of the cast had never acted before, you know, there's a, like, you know, which was another thing that Cassandra, casting did, which is really finding these unique play, these unique folks who like the, like, for example, the skateboarders, they'd never acted before.
Well, they were great. Yeah, they were before. Great.
And
very natural.
Totally. And the kid who, is at the door when he goes to pick her up at the school dance, like that, that kid, he had no idea what was coming on take one. He had no idea. And, you know,
which helped the character.
Totally.
He had the deer in the headlights look when he saw the dad, you know, just, but it was.
And yeah, it was great. And he was like, when he's like, what have you doing? I'm going to do to your phone. You know, he's whispering all that stuff to him. He's like, what? Yeah. And, you know, and like, the guy who plays the head of, who's doing all the interrogation, like he's a retired, DEA officer, you know, guy who lives in Ohio, and he had never been in a movie before. And, you know, so there's, so it's just this cast of just like folks who are coming from such different backgrounds. And that kind of also helped everybody just like mellow everything out. Cause okay, here we are. This is what we got to do today. Let's all start doing it. And, you know, so it's really like, I mean, you're making a movie and you're intense in it like that. It's just, it becomes more like a very small family, which is kind of unique, because you just, every day is like, you know, you just, this is, you know, like all the guys who played in ICE, who were like all the army dudes, they were professionals. They were not part of ICE. They were just, like the lead guy who's got the beard. He, you know, he's a really stocky dude. He like is, he's Ukrainian, speaks Ukraine, you know, does do. So it was always very interesting having conversations. He lives in Texas. And it's just like, you know, these guys come from all these different backgrounds and you're all just kind of there and you're like, so what did you do? And you know, so you just, this collection of folk. And I think those stories are really critical to like, you know, just you get all these people in one space and stuff happens, you know.
Just, I loved that Leo's character actually does nothing in the entire movie. Like he drives no action. He messes up multiple times. People have to save his butt left and right. And, you know, he doesn't do anything. And at the end of the movie, he's still drinking and smoking weed. Like nothing has changed about him. He's still just sort of a F up the entire time. That was an interesting message to me.
No, yeah, totally. It's like, you know, he basically just wears one outfit the entire thing. He wears a bathrobe. And it's like, you know, it's pretty wild. And yeah, it's just really like, this is a guy who's just trying to get through the day, trying to figure out how to raise his daughter, trying to have some sort of a moral compass, and just like used to be this, you know, in this radical group, and then just kind of like, okay, I'm going to pretend I'm a radical, but I'm really not. I'm just going to sit here and watch, you know, Battle of Algiers and get high all day. And it's just like, but still has this whole past, and it's just, yeah, but you said it, you know, he's just, he doesn't really, you know, he's always two steps behind. He falls off the building. He doesn't have the athleticism, you know, all that business, gets tased, you know, just all the craziness.
He spends half the movie trying to remember the password that he can't remember.
Yes.
Have you ever filmed in Wisconsin? Our governor this month was just touting a new $5 million film tax credit. I think every state practically has that, but
I know.
You've never filmed here?
I haven't. No.
Why not?
You know, I think, you know, everything unfortunately about our business is driven by incentives. And if people are going to go to the Midwest to shoot, they're going to end up shooting in Chicago because that's where most of the crew is. And there's stages there and all that. Because when you did, well, okay, so right after this, when we finished shooting this movie, I did this Netflix thing, Monster, about a classic Wisconsin craftsman, you know, Ed Gein.
And I was offended that was not filmed in Wisconsin.
I know. And we ended up filming it in on stage in LA and then in Illinois for all the exteriors and everything. And I was like, and I even drove up to Plainfield and all that kind of stuff and saw, you know, I was like, well, I got to go to the city. But it's that's the thing on our business, which is all incentive based. Unfortunately, that's a massive, massive, decision maker on where you end up shooting movies, unless there's some critical thing like we got to shoot at the Wisconsin Dells because it's the Dells. Okay, yeah, well then that's different, you know.
I feel bad that people from California can't tell the difference between Illinois and Wisconsin.
I know, huh? You know.
On your way up to Plainfield, on the left in Portage, by the way, is the prison where Jeffrey Dahmer was killed by another inmate. So there's a whole tour of killers there on whatever that highway is.
No, well, it's funny that series, that Netflix series of the three seasons, two of them are based on Wisconsin, killers, basically.
I was thinking if somebody ever does the Mike Ballman story, I'm thinking Woody Harrelson would play you.
Oh, yeah.
I've always thought there's kind of a similarity there.
He's the man. I got to work with him once on a movie, and it was really, it's a really cool dude. Very down to earth, good person. So yeah.
Do you get back to Wisconsin much anymore? Your parents are still here, I think.
Yeah, my parents are there. My brother's there, so I get back there. But it's not as much as I'd like. Hey,
congratulations on your success.
Oh, thank
you. We're all proud of you here.
Thank you so much.
Our theme music is by Tube Tester.